Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
Our guest today, for the second week in a row, is a blackjack player who posts on the forums under the name The Doc. Doc, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you for having me.
Before we get back to blackjack, in your notes it says you're a certified sommelier, meaning you know a whole lot about wine. Now, usually that's for people in the food and beverage industry, and your education is in being a doctor, which is kind of a labor-intensive education. So how did you become a sommelier?
So my wife and I have always enjoyed, you know, wine and studying about wine and wine culture. But the reason why I did that was I watched a documentary called Somm about four candidates who were sitting for the Master Sommelier exam, which apparently is one of the most difficult examinations in the world to pass. And there are four levels of sommelier certification in the Quartermaster Sommeliers. There's an introductory certification, a certified certification, an advanced certification, and a master certification. And I think in the history of the organization, there have been about 300 master sommeliers in the world. So it's extremely difficult. I just kind of got fascinated with the challenge of it. So I pursued it as far as a non-food and beverage professional can, which is up through the second level. So basically the first level, you know, you study independently and you take a test and it's just pure theory. The second level, which I passed, you have to, and this is kind of an interesting thing to practice, you have to pass a more advanced theory test. You have to blindly identify four wines, which, although that sounds like a parlor trick, there is a method to it. And it's not as hard as it sounds. It just requires you to drink a lot of wine for practice, which is not bad. And then the third thing you have to do is you actually have to perform champagne service to a table of master sommeliers while they ask you all kinds of esoteric questions about wine and wine service. So that for me was the hardest part because, I mean, I've never professionally served any beverage to anyone. But, you know, I think people in medicine, people in advantage play, they get compulsive and obsessed with certain things, and it was just something fun to say that I did. And I did apply to try to take it to the next level, and they promptly said no because I didn't have any food and beverage experience. But, you know, if someone studied medical books for years and decide they want to take the surgery boards, I probably would frown on that too.
Huh.
But my understanding is that you can take the bar exam, that you can take the bar exam and become a lawyer without going to law school. At least that's what I was told. Maybe I'm wrong about that, but
that's actually true. But in certain jurisdictions, that's true. I know in California in particular, if you are mentored or have some exposure to the legal system that's structured, you're allowed to take the bar in California. And then, you know, if you practice there for X number of years, you can oftentimes transfer your license through, you know, reciprocity agreements. And that's why most of the online law schools allow you to sit for the bar in California, because you don't need a law school at all. But we don't like lawyers anyway. So.
I do compliment for his nice segue on sommeliers to the bar. It was pretty clever. And let's get back to blackjack. Stardust, it's no longer there. Did you like playing there?
I did. I mean, it was a place when I was betting green that you could still get, you know, nice comps. They were very slow to back me off, which was nice. And prior to doing that, I did have one dealer that I would literally follow from table to table, which was pretty brazen. But she was from Ethiopia. And, you know, the Stardust, if you recall, when they would deal their double deck games, which, you know, once again, when we get to advice for new counters, first advice is don't play double deck games. But anyway, as I was playing the double deck games, I advise no one to play. They never used a cut card. The dealers would shuffle at their discretion, which always raised the threat of a preferential shuffle. But I didn't observe that in my play. This particular dealer would decide to shuffle when she thought she might run out of cards on the next hand, which in a heads-up game was just the most stellar penetration you could ever imagine. And in addition, she was a front-loading dealer. So it was my first exposure to really to next card information as well. So I would follow her all over the place. And, you know, when I got backed off there and then the Stardust closed, that went away. And I actually made an effort to try to figure out where she went to deal after that and never was able to. But it was a great play for a while.
The Stardust was notorious in the early 80s. There was a very blatant whole card dealer who would deal seconds and just, you know, cheat people out of their money. But he would lure them in by very obviously exposing his whole card. But, you know, word kind of spread very quickly that that was what was going on. So people
you know, I never
to avoid him.
Do you think that when you run into a situation like that, is the dealer just trying to see what they can do, or are they working for the casino? I can't imagine the casino would back a play like that. I think sometimes it's just a mechanic seeing what they can get away with.
Well, I've certainly run into that, a mechanic seeing what they can get away with. I have numerous stories about this, but at that time, in the early 80s, remember, this is when Frank Rosenthal was still running the Stardust, the time in the movie Casino, and so it was the mob, and it wouldn't surprise me if they were behind it. I did know one guy who used to cheat players in Reno, and he said that the bosses never told him to do it. He did take it on himself, but he felt like the bosses knew if they put him on a game that he was going to win. But as I say, they never expressly told him to do it. He just took it on himself to do it. So
employee of the year.
Why would he talk to you and admit this?
Well, people talk to me, Bob. They told me all kinds of things. I mean, I now consider this guy a friend, actually. He's no longer a dealer. He hasn't been a dealer for a long time. But, So, you know what's interesting? People used to speculate a lot about the dealer had to make if the dealers were cheating to dump off money to an agent, that they have to cheat other players to make up for it so that their table didn't always look like it was losing. And I've met dealers who have expressed both sides of that. One guy said, "That's just crazy. I would never do that because now you're moving twice as much. So you have twice as much of a chance of getting caught doing something." But the other one, who dealt in kind of smaller casinos where they would notice the rack missing a lot of money, said that he did occasionally cheat players to make up for what he was dumping off to an agent. So
is casino cheating in Nevada a felony?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yep.
Well, let me tell you, this is interesting. In my state, they busted a politician in the casino I was describing to you earlier, a drunken politician who apparently was he was either pinching or capping bets. And he wasn't doing like a Dustin Marks cheating move. He was just drunk and sloppy and obviously, you know, just either capping or pinching bets. I'm not sure what it was. But they arrested him and kicked him out. And I think in this jurisdiction, it's a misdemeanor.
Well, yeah. So,
I've never heard. Felony universally. You know.
No, but see, that's the thing. Just as an example, anytime on the internet somebody brings up the idea of using a computer to play blackjack, immediately people will jump on there and say it's a felony. You'll go to jail, and they don't know that. Yes, it's a felony in Nevada. But that doesn't mean it's a felony everywhere else in the United States. So Yeah, every state has their own set of laws, and they're not all the same. And many of the states have copied Nevada's laws, but not all of them. So, yeah.
Well, bring your computer and come on down.
We'll
make some.
By the way, you're asking about dealers who take it upon themselves. There was a guy that was they caught him from the Eye in the Sky dealing seconds. This was many, many years ago at the Flamingo, when they had a lot of double deck games, and they caught him dealing seconds, and they called gaming, and gaming came in, and they watched this guy for a week, and he just appeared to be doing it randomly. Sometimes it would help the player, sometimes it would hurt the player. He wasn't dumping off money to agents, and they couldn't figure out what the hell he was doing. So they finally, after a week, they busted the guy. They bring him into the security office, and gaming is there. And they say, "What the hell are you doing?" And he said, "Practicing." like it was the most natural thing in the world. And so, yeah, there's a lot of boneheads out there.
That's unbelievable.
You were talking about the Stardust. My only play at the Stardust, this would have been in the late 80s, early 90s. I was a low-stake player where you got, if you played so many hours for nickels or dimes or something, you got a deal. So I was there playing, and there was this guy next to me who was so drunk, like his head was on the table, not faking it. And the pit boss was bringing him another marker to sign, saying, "I think with another 20,000, your luck is going to change." So she was forcing him, while he was dead drunk, had no idea what he was doing, to sign another marker. And he was clearly buried and clearly out of it. I did not speak up. I did not want to get my dick in a ringer and get mixed up in it. But it was like, that was the only time I saw it. I'd heard it happen in a lot of places, but this was the only time I saw it, and it was ugly.
Well, and that's the paradox of the casino industry, and why I like taking as much money as I can away from them, because they're more than content to let you go completely broke and ruin lives, but you show them any evidence that you're a winning player and you're out.
When I was a dealer, I one time came up on a game, and there was a guy who was like you. I mean, he just was slurring his words, just totally, totally wasted. And once I got to the game, I started dealing, and this guy took out a handful of Valium. Now, he's already completely wasted. He takes a handful of Valium, pops them in his mouth, and chugs down a beer to swallow them. And, he's betting black chips. And I look at the boss, and I'm like, do you think we should do something about this before this guy dies in here? Or, and the boss was just like, dummy up and deal the cards. And they waited until he lost what was left of his chips, and then security kind of carried him up to a room. They gave him a room and put them in there.
That's
and
nice of them.
Not to drift over into the medical, but that for biochemical reasons, that particular combination is exceptionally lethal.
Yeah.
Okay, now Doc, you've heard a lot of our shows. You have heard a lot of them deal with blackjack players with various ways to approach it. Is the way you approach winning at blackjack different than other people you've heard? And if so, how?
I think most people who are doing this professionally or semi-professionally, once again, probably have a designated bankroll. And I don't. I have a replenishable bankroll. So, my bet sizes may vary trip to trip, but I always you know, calculate the EV. And I think you need to be aware of what your risk of ruin and what your EV is. If you're willing to accept a little higher risk of ruin, whatever, I mean, that's personal, but I think these are things you need to do the calculations on and know what to expect. Just a general advice for new players, you know, I think there's, first of all, I think people need to understand what they're signing up for, that counting is a grind, that you are scrounging for a 1% to 2% edge, which means you're going to, you know, lose 48% of the time. It's a long-run game. You're going to have wins. You're going to have losses, just like basic strategy players occasionally win. You know, I think people need to realize that it is a grind. I think there's a tendency for people to overestimate their skills and underestimate the number of errors they make. So I do think that formal vetting, either with a partner or, say, like the way the Blackjack Apprenticeship guys have set up their tests, I think that's an outstanding model to learn. You can't really prepare and practice enough before you go into a casino, because the minute that you do, you're going to be in a totally sensory overload environment. It's going to affect your play, and you need to be prepared for that. I think you pick a count system after you've learned basic strategy cold. And I would say the simpler the better with respect to counts. I think that, you know, high-low is what I use, and I've been through all of these, okay? I mean, when I was doing a lot of double deck play early in my career, I thought I needed to learn a level 2 count because I thought I needed higher playing efficiency. And all it did was really just create more errors. So I tried the unbalanced Zen 2, and I tried the advanced Omega 2. Both were a complete bust. And I went back to high-low, and I've been happy with that. Because really, particularly, I think in today, the future of the game is the 6-deck shoe. You have more sustained positive counts. You know, there's not a shuffle every 3 minutes. There's less heat. And, you know, less likely to take a back off. I just think that handheld games are really not the what you need to focus on. I'd start with high-low with the illustrious 18 to start, and then add index numbers as you feel comfortable. And what I've done is I've told people that I've sort of mentored to learn from indices about -2 up to 5. And the reason why I say -2 is if the count's below -2, you need to go to the bathroom. And if the count is 5, that's really, you know, that's going to get most of your true count situations, cover most of your true count situations. And you start with the 18, the illustrious 18, and then just add indices as you master the count system. I don't think.
Now, when you say the illustrious 18, do you split 10?
Oh, no. You can call it the sweet 16 then. No, I don't split 10s. But, you know, that's the sort of the industry lingo, so I use that. But I think, you know, bankroll management's a big deal. I think people, I see a lot of people underbetting their advantage if they're spooked from a losing streak. I see sometimes people overbet their advantage if they're behind, or if they, you know, if the ramp calls for 125 and 200 must be better, I think that's going to really pump up the variance, and contribute to a higher risk of ruin. And I think, you know, game selection is a big deal. You know, don't, just because you have a hammer doesn't mean everything should start to look like a nail. You know, really scout out the best games with the best rules, and cannot stress the importance of good pen. Now, with respect to cover, and I like to bring this up because, you know, and I appreciate the work of Ian Anderson in the Ultimate Gambit, I've never used cover plays. I think that the edge that you have is so small, if you give it, any of it away, you're getting too close to break even. And in addition, I think that some of the index plays look like cover plays. So, for example, okay, the best example I can think of right off the top, everybody knows that selective taking of insurance is going to kind of raise the eye of the pit as to whether or not you're a skilled player. Take insurance in a high count, you insure stiff in a high count, something like that, it's going to maybe get their attention. But, for example, the index for the high-low index for hitting a 12, a hard 12 against a dealer up card of 4 is 0. So in any negative running count, you're going to hit your 12. Well, to everyone at the table, you're going to look like an idiot, but that's the correct play. And I think that that's not as well known to the pit. So in my mind, the more index numbers you play, the more deviations you make. I think there's some cover value in that because they don't look like standard basic strategy plays. Richard, what do you think about that?
I agree with everything that you said. I mean, I went through the same thing when I first started. I was playing a lot of single and double deck, so I learned the high op too. But yeah, I agree. Learn the high low, and it's just not that hard to memorize the index numbers. Like you said, -2 to +5, or in Wong's book he had -1 to +6. Whatever. I mean, it's just not that many indexes. And obviously the positive numbers are more important because you're going to be betting more money,
Right.
So yeah, no, I agree with you. And your edge is too small to make cover plays. Although I also agree not splitting tens, probably not doubling ace nine, cause that's kind of the equivalent of splitting tens. I'm in complete agreement with you.
But I think that the other thing I will say, I like KO too. And I especially like KO with the color of blackjack adjustments, because I think the unbalanced counts, and Grosjean kind of alluded to this in Beyond Counting, they kind of underestimate your advantage early in the shoe and overestimate it later. And the color of blackjack adjustments, make up for that with a rounded set of indices. But the reason why I still suggest people do high-low is because it's kind of like if you want to go to Mexico, you need to learn Spanish. And I believe that high-low has become sort of a universal language among the teams and, Blackjack Apprenticeship, for example, if you wanted to hone your skills and go take a boot camp, they're not going to be prepared to test you in KO, for example. So I think that, the widespread applicability and the universal language that high-low provides is a good – it makes it the best choice. And the other thing to tell people, I think, that people don't really think about is, once you've got the counting down, and you're moving your bets accordingly and making the right index plays, look for other advantage plays. And if you're lucky enough to spot one, know what to do with it. So, for example, if you spot a flasher – but you don't know anything about whole card strategy, you're going to lose a lot of value on the play.
Right. Go ahead, Bob.
At the same time, there are 100 different games that could become good if you know the right strategies, and being up on all of them, in case you run into it, is a daunting task.
I agree with that. I think that, the certainly one card poker and Mississippi Stud and some others are sort of the classic examples. And fortunately, the strategies for exploiting those opportunities aren't that difficult. There's only a couple. I mean, maybe to fully exploit them, there's more than I know, but there's some pretty simple adjustments if you can get a little bit of additional information. The one thing I've noticed, though, is, and I don't know if this is a result of the Caesars case, but it looks to me like in a lot of places the game protection has gotten a little better on the Carnival games than it historically was.
Sure, it has. People... It was really low-hanging fruit, so lots of people started playing, people that were never players in the past, but they heard about it, found out about it one way or another, and so lots and lots of people started playing, and the more, kind of like the law of the jungle, right? If there's too much prey, the predators are going to come out, and it's cyclical. So now it's gotten harder to beat. A lot of those players didn't have the skills to adapt, so they've moved on to other things. Many of them have now moved into slots because that's the low-hanging fruit right now. things always keep changing.
I think, too, one thing that's hindered me in exploiting some opportunities is that, you know, as a lone wolf, you know, a lot of these plays are not really as effective unless you can kind of take the table over or at least have two or three other players with you. And I'm talking about specific skilled cutting or tracking, you know, it really helps to increase your odds of getting the card you want. Fair enough.
Yeah, sure. And, you know, the other thing that I would say when you were talking about advice to new players is I think the other most important thing is to start building a network, because you just can't, you're going to learn so much by meeting other players. So, you know, you have to establish a network, and the way to do that is online these days. The forums have gotten kind of bad. We were talking about earlier, but you know, there's the Discord channel. But wherever you can, you know, should reach out and try to make friends within the community.
Yeah, I have a little geographic disadvantage there, but I've made an effort to network with some players in Vegas, and I've had some pretty good. You know, some pretty good interaction with some local players in Vegas, but they've really been more social. We haven't, you know, really partnered to take anything down. But really, that's what I'm interested in doing is, you know, I'd like to expand. Once again, if I'm going to do this full time at the conclusion of my surgical career, I think you need to have more than counting in a tank.
Yeah.
All right.
Now,
we're going to follow that up about what the doc is going to do when he grows up. Right after we take this commercial break, and then we'll get back to what he sees his long-term future is, and we'll let Richard ask whatever that question was that was at the tip of his tongue when I cut him off. The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else has. In August, the prizes are logo merchandise advertising the South Point or the South Point 400 NASCAR race. Each week, Monday through Thursday, earn 1,300 points on any machine and get the prize. If you pick up the logo merchandise for all 4 weeks, you will receive $100 in free play on Saturday, August 31st. The next 10-week semester of free video poker classes will begin the day after Labor Day, Tuesday, September 3rd, starting at noon. The first class is Jacks Are Better. There are flyers available at the club booth with the class schedule, and they also may be found at bobdancer.com/seminar. Everyone is welcome to attend. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most of the games. The game of the week is Wheel Poker. This is a 6 coins per line game where you get to spin a wheel when you end up with 4 of a kind. The average wheel spin is worth about 420 coins. The correct strategy isn't hard to work out. If you were playing a game where the quads were worth 250, 400, and 800, for example, if you add 420 to each of them, you get 670, 820, and 1220, and then you work out the strategy. The hands that change in value aren't that many. You check out such things as low pair versus four card straights, or two pair versus the full house, and whether it's smart to keep kickers with 3 of a kind. There are a few other hands to look at, but not very many. All right, we are back talking with the doc. He started to say when I cut him off, what he plans to do when his future, when he retires from surgery. So I'm assuming if you have a choice between being a sommelier and a professional AP, you're going the AP route. What would you like to do?
So, that's my goal. I'd like to, retire to a gaming destination. Vegas would be the logical choice. And then define a portion of my retirement as bankroll. That amount to be determined by, the EV of what I, would need to live on and just basically enter a second career as a full-time player. You know, that's the goal. I've discussed that with my wife, and she goes back and forth on it, but, you know, she's a lover of Vegas, so I think I'll get her sold on it. The problem is, of course, I'm probably between 10 and 15 years from that transition. So I'll keep trying to diversify my skill set and have a better chance of making that work out when the time comes.
So have you tracked in terms of number of hours what your longest losing streak has been over the years?
I would say, and I don't know how this really weighs in with, you know, some of your other guests, but in the neighborhood of 60 hours, which was pretty defeating for me because, once again, my play sessions sometimes are spaced out by a couple of months, depending on how much I'm traveling. But it was a very, very, very emotionally defeating time. I still can't disconnect completely from how I made the money. And, you know, and when I have a big losing session or a sustained losing streak, it is very defeating. Now, fortunately, you know, I play through that and will come out on the other end eventually. And I know that. I trust the math. But it doesn't make it easy. I mean, anyone who's completely emotionally disconnected from it's a better man than me.
No, I think it is one of the really difficult parts about this career. And actually, I'm surprised because, you know, you probably should have had a 100-hour plus losing streak over 20 years of play. You know, and I kind of, you know, measure people by how they weathered a 100-hour losing streak, but you haven't had one yet, it sounds like. So, yeah, and I wouldn't wish it on anybody.
Yeah, I mean, I think, too, what would be defeating would be, you know, if you were on a non-replenishable bankroll, if you had to downsize your bets, you know,
yeah,
then to me, it's like it's going to take you that much longer to even recover. And these are the things I think about when I think about full-time play. Because what I would have to do, I think, if I wanted to do it full-time after retirement, is I would have to respect the constraint of the bankroll that I set aside and not keep going back to the kitty to replenish it like I've done in the past. Because then basically,
yeah,
you know, I'm cutting into the vital funds that I'm really, you know, supposed to sustain my golden years.
Right.
Now, Richard, you said several times that if you're primarily a card counter, Vegas is one of the worst places to do it. And so Doc is thinking about retiring and moving to Vegas. Does that sound right to you, Richard?
Well, Vegas has a lot of other things to offer. So, but if your move here was strictly about counting cards, then I would say no, Vegas is not the place to move. Maybe Pennsylvania is, I don't know. But I mean, as I'm sure you know, Vegas is kind of the toughest location to count cards in now. They are very quick to pick you off, and they communicate so well with each other now that, you know, once you get picked off, suddenly, you know, there's a flyer out and you can't play anywhere. So
yeah, I'm confident the only reason why I'm able to travel to Vegas semi-regularly is because it's not that frequent. You know, I'm pretty sure that if the trips there were more frequent, I would not be able to play. So, you know, what I'm hoping is that I have other AP skills in the tank that are a little better than they are right now that I'd be willing to hang my hat on them. For example, you know, I play Hold'em profitably in destinations other than Vegas. But, you know, a lot of the poker games in Vegas are so strong at any bet level that really I don't fare nearly as well. Pennsylvania, you know, the thing about Pennsylvania, they do have great games from a rules perspective. They don't have a ton of casinos, so I think you might be overexposed if you try to do that full time. That would be the downside. And it's just not a place I want to retire. So maybe there'll be some.
Well, yeah, retirement is also about lifestyle and where you want to live, you know. So And Vegas has a lot to offer. I mean, so, and, you know, there's plenty of places to play that are not that far away from Las Vegas.
Right.
And are certainly far away from an airport.
Is single deck still alive and well in Reno? I mean, is it legitimate single deck games?
Not much, no. But I think it may still be alive in Wendover, but I'm not sure.
Well, that's a place that's easy to overexpose yourself.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, so when I was first learning the mechanics of counting, you know, and I recognized it wasn't the best game, but, you know, to just see how it worked, you know, playing red chips at Binion's was one of my favorite things to do. Just kind of watch the magic happen. You know, you could bet a 5-25 spread and, you know, make a couple hundred dollars and just see how the count worked. And obviously, you know, single deck games are much more volatile and require a lot more deviations and so forth. But that was great practice. And, you know, they knew I was counting, and they never did anything more than flat bet me. I mean, the old Binion's was really kind of a special place in a lot of ways.
They didn't have...
That's to put it mildly. Yeah.
Yes.
And I did survive.
They didn't have red chips. They had blue chips.
So listen, so I took my dad to Vegas one time, and he, by the way, got so upset at the amount that I was betting that he told me I should take up a less risky hobby. And I said, well, what would you suggest? And he suggested I take flying lessons. So, I mean, I don't know what he thinks. I haven't had two acquaintances that have died as private pilots. So I don't know what message he was sending me, but anyway, I took him to Vegas and we were going to be there for 5 nights. So I said, well, we'll stay one night downtown so you can see old Las Vegas. And we'll stay 4 nights on the Strip. So the first night we were there, I booked us a hotel room at Binion's, and I fed him dinner at the snack bar. So I wanted to get the real food. Yeah, the old snack bar where they serve the chili, you know, the... I drug him to the Western. Like I wanted him to get the full flavor of downtown. So when we caught the taxi to the Strip the next day, he was more than happy to check into the Mirage.
Yeah.
But you know, hey, they didn't have any dollar games at the Mirage, so it was harder for him to play.
Yeah.
Yes. It is a lovely casino. So you mentioned Blackjack Apprenticeship a few times. As it happens, a week from today on this show, we're going to be interviewing Colin Jones, who is the leader of Blackjack Apprenticeship, because he has a new book out called The 21st Century Card Counter. So we don't always get to foreshadow who's coming next week, but thank you, Doc, for giving us a
lead-in.
An interesting way to do that.
Well, I think that the way those guys have formalized the training process and, you know, constructed their boot camps and things like that, I've not participated. But, you know, I saw the original documentary on the church team, Holy Rollers, a few years ago. And
uh-huh.
I was familiar with them. And then when Blackjack Apprenticeship came out and, the training tools they developed and the boot camps they put on, it's really a neat business model. And I've been really impressed with what they've been able to accomplish.
Yeah, no, I think they do a very good job. I don't want to, you know, become a commercial for boot camp, but I have to say the response from the people who take the boot camp all seems to be extremely positive. So, you know, they're doing something right, and we've had a lot of guests on the show that have gone through the boot camp and gone out and made six figures, you know.
Or seven,
yeah. I mean, so they're doing something right.
Yeah, I can think of a few that have been on here just recently. And I think it just sort of speaks to how much their presence has sort of permeated the marketplace for training new APs.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of people have tried that in the past. I mean, going all the way back to Ken Houston and Howard Grossman. And, there's just been a lot of people who have tried to turn that into a business and not done it very successfully. But Colin seems to have done it. So
that's funny, you know, when you used to read the early Blackjack books, you know, and I'm talking about like Revere's book and Lance Humble's book, you know, you could read the book and you could get the basic system. But if you wanted the real gain, you have to send in the $200 and get the super secret system, you know, from the professor himself, you know.
Yeah, and Revere used to give private lessons. I had a number of friends who actually took lessons from Revere, and he was basically a con man, and he would, he would without you knowing it, remove a card from the deck and then say, count this down, you know, and it's supposed to be. Yeah, it's supposed to be zero at the end, and you'd end up with plus one or whatever. And he's like, "Well, you need more lessons." So,
well, I mean, if you read Lance Humble's book, I mean, the central message of that book is he doesn't like Revere. You know, they must have had a really rocky relationship.
Yeah,
there's a lot of negative references to Revere in that book.
Yeah, he didn't have a lot of respect for pit bosses. He did have several, how many pit bosses does it take to change a light bulb kind of jokes in there. And
well, he was also convinced that all the casinos were cheating, too. That, you know, whenever he lost, it was because they were cheating him.
So Humble felt that way?
Yeah, yeah. If you read any of Humble's books, he talks a lot about, you know, the casinos cheating, which I think was...
It's like you said, you know, when he was playing, you know, Vegas was mobbed up a lot more than it is today.
Well, but the cheating was still really rare. You know, no, I mean, I'm not talking about the 60s. You know, his books came out, I think, in the early 80s, maybe the late 70s, and that's when I started playing, and as I say, it was pretty rare. I mean, it happened once in a while, and, you know, word would go around, like, oh, there's this dealer here or that dealer there, but I just think that until we got better computers where people could run more simulations, people didn't realize that it was normal to have a 100-hour losing streak, you know?
Yeah. No, fair enough. And I think, you know, too, that when you realize, you know, that if a casino's cheating by policy, and I don't mean like one dealer practicing dealing seconds, but if a casino's dealing, you know, cheating by order, by decree, then they're risking their you know, zillions of dollars with their gaming license. So,
that's a myth. That's really a myth. They would never do anything they would never take somebody's gaming license or shut them down or, you know, I mean, there was that incident at the Venetian where they rigged a drawing and they gave them a slap on the wrist of some sort. And I've told this story on the air before, but, back, 10 or 15 years ago, I was producing a show for the Travel Channel, or I was a segment producer, and we were interviewing the head of gaming enforcement. And at the time, a very, very well-respected member of the blackjack community, author, was convinced that there was a casino here in Vegas that was shorting the shoe. And and this is, you know, a lot of people, you would just sort of go, oh, yeah, the guy's a nut. But, you know, this is a really well-respected member of the blackjack community. And I was telling this to the other producer on this show, and now we go to interview the head of gaming enforcement. And while we're on a break resetting the cameras, he says to this guy, he says to the head of gaming enforcement, hey, you know, I know one of these low-life card counter type guys who's convinced that there's a casino where they're taking cards out of the shoe. And what would you do if that happened? And he said, oh, we would take that very seriously. He says, the first thing we would do is we would send them a letter.
Well, that,
and I just started laughing. You know, it's like, yeah, you're taking that seriously, all right.
But it would be, the letter would be very, very strongly worded.
That's right, yeah.
So I agree. Vegas is not.
And, you know, here's the other thing. You know, whenever I have run into that type of cheating, where they are shorting the shoe, they're never subtle about it. It's not like they only took out, you know, four cards or something. I mean, you get to the end, you get to the cut card, and the count is plus 25. It's,
oh, yeah.
You know, so it's, you know, if somebody were subtle and smart about it, they could increase their edge for the house by 1% or 2% and probably go unnoticed. But no, they want, you know, 4 or 5%.
I mean, obviously, I can't, you know, I didn't, I mean, I couldn't verify it, but, you know, on several cruises I've been on, one particular cruise line, you know, they've pulled the shoes out, preloaded, didn't spread the cards at the beginning of the session, and I've had consistently, you know, monster counts and huge losing sessions, you know. I think they were taking cards out. And I don't know, you know, once again, you have no way to prove it, but just the math was not consistent with.
Did you try asking them to spread the cards?
No, I did. Well, I mean, I did at one point, and they refused. So I just stopped playing. I didn't play the game for the rest of the cruise.
Huh.
I think I think you're much more likely to get cheated, you know, abroad than you are in the United States, of course. And
absolutely,
and,
yeah.
And you just can never. You know, I've played a lot in Aruba, and you know, once again, I've always been there when the cards were spread and so forth. And they don't deal a great game, but I think it's at least where I've played the two major casinos I've played most consistently. I think it's been a fair game. It's just not been a great game.
Yeah.
Another and with that, Doc. And with that, Doc, we're out of time. I want to thank you for both this week and last week. It's been quite interesting. Hope your career as a doctor and then an AP continues to go well. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. It's been a highlight.
Richard, thank you again. Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.